And so good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Purdue Student Advocacy Resources Panel. Our panelists today are from Student Legal Services, CARE, Ace Food Pantry, and GROW. So without further ado, I'll pass it over to Leslie Charters from Student Legal Services.
Thank you, Prateek. Hi, everyone. My name is Leslie Charters. I am Purdue's Director of Student Legal Services. And that means I am your lawyer. I am the only lawyer on campus for students at Student Legal Services. So I have potentially have 46,000 clients. I stay pretty busy. And before I came to Purdue, I worked my first job out of law school as a practicing attorney was as a deputy prosecuting attorney here in Tippecanoe County. So I dealt with a lot of different types of criminal cases. And then after that, I switched over to the public defender's office. So then I saw the opposite side of criminal law for about 9 months before I came to Purdue. And now Student Legal Services has been at Purdue since I started in 2013. So going on 8 years. That's it. I'll pass it to the next person.
My name is Tammy Patrick, and I am the director of the Center for Advocacy, Response, and Education, otherwise known as CARE. And I am an office of one right now with Leslie, but hopefully this summer I will be authorized to hire a couple of full-time people to assist me. So I provide confidential advocacy surrounding power-based personal violence and do prevention education for all of the campus. And I'm really excited to be here to share some more information with you today.
Thank you, Tammy. Riley, you want to go next?
Sure. My name's Riley. I'm a junior in Brain and Behavioral Sciences. I've been with the ACE Campus Food Pantry since late 2019, and I've done a lot of different roles, but right now I'm our event director and one of the shift leads. So if you come to the pantry from 12 to 3, then I'll be the one serving you. Yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Thanks, Riley. Roberta?
Hi, I'm Roberta Weiner. You can call me Rob. I'm a second-year PhD student in Agricultural Science Education Communication, and I'm a member of the Guiding Committee of Graduate Rights and Our Well-Being, or GROW. We are a graduate labor organization that run by graduate workers for graduate workers, and we advocate for your workplace rights.
Thank you. So pretty much the format for this event is that we'll have each resource present for about 10 to 20 minutes and then followed by Q&A for that specific resource. And then we'll move along to the next cycle around through all four of them. So Leslie, do you want to take over?
Sure. Okay. So I really appreciate you putting on this panel, and I think it will be very beneficial for students. Even, you know, now that it's being recorded, they can watch it anytime. So I know that this is part of Mental Health Action Week. And at Student Legal Services, our tagline is we provide free confidential legal advice providing that helps students with their peace of mind, right? To help them get through legal issues so that you can focus on your studies and not on your legal issues. At Student Legal Services, like I said, it's free advice, but remember, it's advice only. So I can't represent students in court. I spend all of my time helping students, empowering them to figure out their legal issue and the best way to deal with it. You know, and sometimes there's not really a great way to deal with a legal issue. I just give them all of the possibilities of outcomes of a legal issue and then help them make the most educated decision with their legal issue. So at Student Legal Services, you have to set up an appointment, you have to fill out an intake form on our website. That's the first step. We don't take walk-ins, things like that, especially during the pandemic. It's really important that students go to our website first and fill out the intake form. And only this year during the pandemic, we are doing email appointments and phone call appointments. In the past, it was you had to come in person for an appointment, but now with the pandemic, we had to do something a little different. But I hope to be meeting with my clients one-on-one very soon, right? As soon as we can get vaccinated. Yay! So I'm going to pull up my website because I want to just show you a couple things. And then I have a few slides I want to show you about common legal issues that students face, especially grad students. So first, I'm going to do the screen share. Hopefully you can see what I'm sharing here. Right. And I'm going to, here's our website. So it's purdue.edu/SLS. And it goes to this other website, odos/SLS. But if you just type in SLS at the end, it'll go to this website too. So the first thing you have to do is click Access Legal Services to fill out an intake form here. And then you fill it out, tell us what your issue is, and then I review it and determine whether it falls within the scope of the types of cases that we handle. So you have our email address here if you do have questions, but, and then parents are my client. So a parent can't just call and say, hey, can you tell me what to do about my student's legal issue? The student actually has to fill out the intake form. Frequently asked questions tells you the types of legal issues that we cover. The two big ones that students face are landlord-tenant law and criminal law. But I handle some other, you know, smaller issues, traffic tickets, that kind of thing. So questions that you need answered about, you know, is your legal issue something that we can handle? I would go here first. But even if it's a legal issue maybe that we don't handle, I say still start with us. Fill out the intake form because many, many times I will say, sorry, this is not our area of expertise, but here's a referral to somebody who can help you. And maybe it's at a reduced cost. So you can always kind of view our office as the default, right? And I wanted to have some fun and show you this cool commercial that we had. We actually had students produce this commercial. So you can kind of see the different types of cases that we handle. So I think it's only like a minute. So just hang with me.
Tried to use his fake ID to get into a bar. Now he'll have to show his real ID to the police. Some undergrad students just make ill-advised decisions.
Hello? When are you gonna come take care of this bug situation? They're everywhere. I called a few days ago, but you haven't sent anyone. Please,
Looks like Bob has a lot of roommates, just not the ones he was looking for. The landlord isn't coming to help out. Watch out.
What do you mean it's double?
We charge you for the two times you came in for repairs.
But you didn't fix it the first time. Why am I paying for a second time?
Things are heating up. Looks like Bob is getting hit with unjust charges. When you find yourself in trouble, you're not alone. Purdue Student Legal Services is here to help, and it's free. All you have to do is contact Purdue Student Legal Services. Confidential advice for peace of mind. Now let's go talk about this speeding ticket.
There you go. I love that commercial. So that's a lot of the types of cases that we handle. So thanks for watching that with me. And then I want to bring up these slides. I'm going to go through them fairly quickly because I know there's not a lot of time. I want to give some time to everybody else to present. Okay, so common legal concerns that graduate students face specifically. First, this is our little postcard. It tells you kind of the areas that we cover. But when it comes to criminal law, these are the, you know, offenses that grad students come to me about: public intoxication, operating while intoxicated, Those I know quite a bit about. I've handled those in the past, both as a prosecutor and as a public defender, so I can help the student with, you know, what are they facing? Should they hire a lawyer? You know, the possible outcomes, consequences, that kind of thing. We talk through the facts and whether there are any defenses and that kind of thing too. And then when it comes to driving offenses, I wanted to point out that students come to me sometimes and say, I was driving and I have a license to drive from my home country, but I was driving here in Tippecanoe County. I got pulled over and I was cited. I was given a citation for driving without a license. And actually in Indiana, if you have an international driver's license and you're here as a student and you have the translation with you, you know, translated into English in your vehicle, and you show that to the officer, that is enough to drive as long as you maintain your status as a student here. So just keep that in mind. Now, is it easier just if you go through the process and get a license in Indiana so that that doesn't happen? Yes, that would be great, but you're not required to do that. So, if you don't have an Indiana driver's license, you definitely have to have those two things, the international license plus the translation. And I believe that there is an office at Purdue, like the languages office, that has in the past done the translations for students. So keep that in mind. Driving while suspended, that's just one that I see sometimes where a student might forget to pay a traffic ticket, or they got into an accident and they were required to provide proof of insurance to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, and maybe that didn't happen. So for one of those situations, if you forgot to pay a ticket or something, your license can get suspended and maybe they don't know about it. But knowledge of your license being suspended is not required for the prosecutor to charge that offense. So keep that in mind too. Make sure you're really up to date on, you know, paying your tickets and stuff like that. Proof of insurance to drive in Indiana, you have to have a minimum type of coverage for to drive, and I would highly recommend you get full coverage because you don't want to be left trying to figure out how to pay for your vehicle and somebody else's. Just get the full coverage if you can. You can check your driver's record through the Indiana BMV when it comes to points and offenses, and to see if the proof of insurance is there. And then I have students come to me about getting traffic tickets quite a bit. So traffic tickets are infractions, which means they are payable. That means there's no possibility that you'll go to jail over a traffic ticket, over an infraction. There are three options when you get a traffic ticket, whether it's, you know, not stopping at a stop sign or speeding, that kind of thing. You can pay the ticket, which is an admission of guilt. And when you click the pay button online and you pay your ticket, you're admitting that that's what you did, and points go on your driver's record. So you got to be aware of that. Second, you can dispute the ticket. If you really feel like you have a good argument, a good case to prove that you weren't speeding, that you didn't, you know, go through the stop sign, that kind of thing, then you have the ability to have a bench trial in front of the judge and, you know, plead your case. And then the third option, which a lot of students don't know exists, is that in many, many traffic ticket situations, a deferral agreement is available. Now, there are certain traffic citations that qualify, but many of the common ones do qualify on a first offense. And a deferral means you pay more money out of pocket than just the regular ticket cost, but you don't get points put on your driver's record, which means insurance rates don't go up. And the deferral information to see if you qualify to apply for it is actually on the Tippecanoe County Prosecutor's website now. So know that that is a possibility, and you should definitely look into it, because I mean, you're not admitting to anything. And then once a certain amount of time goes by, I believe it's like 6 months, then the prosecutor dismisses your ticket after you've accepted the deferral and not gotten a new ticket within that 6 month time. So that's important, something that other students face. All right, I'm gonna fly through here and then we're gonna take some questions. So landlord-tenant situations. These are the areas that I believe are negotiable on a lease. I will just talk about the first one because I think it's probably most important. Is to do your homework first. And competition means when you're thinking about signing with a landlord, you have the best chance of getting the terms that you want if you go to multiple places, get those leases, and compare the terms. If one landlord's requiring you to pay $0 of a security deposit versus another one making you pay $500, well, use the one that's making you, only not asking for a security deposit. Take it to the one that you like if they are asking you to pay and say, hey, can you match this term? Like, I'm thinking about maybe signing with these other people if you won't match it. I mean, make the landlord feel like they have competition, because they do. They really do. There is way more supply in Tippecanoe County now than there is demand. So if a landlord is telling you, you got to sign today, there's 10 people behind you waiting in line to sign for this lease, it's probably not the case. So just know that if you lose the place that you really felt like you wanted and you wanted to sign for, there's probably another very similar place available. And off-campus housing, please visit the Purdue off-campus housing website, talk to their director, because he is very helpful in telling you if the apartment complex, how full they are at that given moment. Like, he finds out in February what are the occupancy rates, how many people have they signed for the following August. From he learns that kind of information from many different landlords. So then you'll know, is this really a time sensitive issue, or can I wait a little bit longer to sign? Okay, before you sign, you can look up your landlord to see if they've been sued or are suing people. There's the off-campus housing website. It should be offcampushousing.purdue.edu. It just changed recently. I'm gonna scroll through that. Okay, after you sign your lease, please make sure you get a copy, get renter's insurance. It's very important. It's about $10 a month. Add it to your current insurance plan, because every year we have students who lose their items in fires, floods, other, devastating circumstances, and the landlord's insurance only covers their building, not your stuff in the building. But the most important thing you can remember from this landlord-tenant part of my presentation is when you move in and when you move out, you must take photos and video of the condition of the rental unit, and take really detailed photos and videos, because you want to show how you received it and how you left it. And it should look the same or better when you leave it versus how you received it. Because we don't want the landlord at the end of your lease charging you for alleged damages when they were already there to begin with, right? You definitely need to document the place, because, and I say it's so important because this is the main piece of evidence that students don't have when they come to see me and say, hey, the landlord charged me so much when I moved out and I left it clean and I didn't even receive it that clean. Like, why am I being charged for all these damages when I didn't do it? And I say, well, did you take pictures when you moved in and when you moved out? And if they say no, then you don't have a great case. So please keep that in mind. Other than that, one more thing I'll say, and then I'll open it up for questions, is I want you to be aware that if there's something you want the landlord to fix, you got to give the landlord notice of it, put it in writing, right? An email, a letter, and then you have to allow a reasonable time for the landlord to fix the problem. Well, what's reasonable is kind of up to you and the landlord. It's kind of, very subjective. And then if you don't get a response, there are resources for you, depending on where you live. Lafayette and West Lafayette both have rental inspections units, and you can fill out a complaint online, tell these offices what the issues are that the landlord is failing to fix, and they will come in and do an inspection and tell the landlord what needs to be fixed. So it's a resource for you to help you, with the circumstances of your living situation if the landlord is neglectful, okay? So, I feel like I've talked really quickly. So that's what the main things I wanted students to know from this presentation. And I would be happy to take some questions. I know I had one that was submitted previously about security deposits and, what they need to know about that. First, a security deposit can be used for unpaid rent and unpaid utilities. But the key issue always is that the security deposit by Indiana law can only be used for damages that are, quote, beyond normal wear and tear, right? Well, what is normal wear and tear? It's very subjective. So the most important information or evidence in that situation is the move-in and move-out photos, right? To be able to argue that you should get more of your deposit back. So yes, our office handles those questions all the time. It's usually mid-September because leases end July 31st usually, and then 45 days after that is when you're supposed to get your information back about your security deposit sometime within those 45 days, and that falls right at mid-September. So that's the main question I get right around that time. Just make sure that when you move out, you give your landlord your key, you document yourself doing that, or send them an email saying, hey, I just turned in my key, and also provide your forwarding address to the landlord in writing. Send them an email again the day you move out and say, hey, just want to let you know I moved out. I turned in my key today at, you know, noon. And here is my forwarding address. This is where I want you to send me information about my deposit. Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you, Leslie.
Yep. I'm going to stop the screen share. Here we go. There we go.
Yeah. Do we have any other questions from our participants? Also posting a few links in the chat that might be useful.
So. I'm gonna put our website in the chat too.
Amazing, yeah.
Okay, does SLS have a list of lawyers who might be willing to represent students pro bono? Well, not necessarily pro bono. Pro bono means free. But in criminal issues, there are about three attorneys in town. If it's a first offense, like public intoxication, possession of marijuana, those kinds of minor offenses, and again, first offense, where the individual is probably going to receive a diversion agreement, there are three lawyers in town with my referral. If you tell them I referred you, they charge students $250 or less to just handle the case. So you don't have to step foot in the courthouse. It's all about convenience. One has even said he would do that for $100. So if you can get, get in touch with them, be one of his clients, then it might be worth it to you. But, in criminal situations on first offenses like that, every student is capable of handling a case like that themselves. If they have come to see me, I walk you through from the point that the officer makes the police report to walking in the courthouse, where you go, what the judge is going to say to you, what you're going to respond, what the diversion agreement looks like, just everything to expect. So, you know, you walk into court feeling pretty confident, like, oh yeah, this isn't a huge, you know, deal, because you usually just go to court one time and you're offered the diversion agreement. So, but I do have lists of lawyers who handle other types of situations too. So if it's, you know, you're filing for divorce, I can help you find lawyers for that. If you're, you know, if you have like a personal injury case, then I can, or a medical malpractice situation, I can get you referrals for pretty much any type of case. Any other questions? Do I have an affordable immigration lawyer that you could recommend? Good question. So Purdue grad student government and Purdue student government have hired an immigration attorney starting this semester. It started in January, and he does one monthly seminar, but also has, I believe it's one day a month that he schedules individual meetings with students about immigration law issues. So while I don't practice immigration law, I think it's great. Lots of students come to me with immigration law questions, and I refer them to that service now because it's free. But also there is there's a website where immigration lawyers have to be a member of this immigration law service. www.ailalawyer.com. And it's all immigration lawyers across the country that are members of this one special immigration lawyers group. That's usually where I send them to. So that's what I can tell you about that. I think it's a great service. You should definitely contact PGSG about, and pay attention to their social media feeds, because they often will post when the next immigration law program is going to take place. All right, I got a few questions. Do students need to re-register their vehicles in Indiana and obtain licenses? What qualifies for residence in Indiana for tax purposes? Oh man, I don't know that I can answer all those. I would, for the tax question, I would suggest just talking to an accountant. A lot of the statutes in Indiana can vary about like what's seen as a resident. Sometimes it's like 60 days. Sometimes it's 6 months you had to have lived in Indiana. So I would just talk to an accountant. And there, and I posted on our social media pages about getting your taxes done for free. So go to Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. We're at Purdue SLS on Instagram and Twitter. Follow us because every week I do a tip of the week on some legal issue that students are facing, and they seem to be fairly helpful to students. Okay, so re-register their vehicles. Good question. I would talk to the Indiana BMV about when is appropriate to do that, how long you've been here, and they'll tell you. The Indiana BMV website is the best place to go, and they have like a chat function and stuff like that. So I would do that for sure. Let's see. I think that's it. I think that was those questions. Thank you for your questions. Any others? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Leslie.
All right, thank you.
Any more questions? I believe we have Leslie for another few more minutes.
I would just like to add to the, Alex, who asked about the qualifying for Indiana residency for tax purposes. If you're a grad student and you're also trying to figure out whether you qualify just as a resident in general, the financial aid website is a really great resource. It actually lists out all of the documents that you need to demonstrate like residency or what's the other, emancipation and all of those types of papers. Financial aid's really in tune with that stuff.
All right, cool. Thanks, Tammy. I guess I did have one question for Leslie. You mentioned that international students can pretty much drive in Indiana on an international license. So there is no set time period for that?
As long as you're a student.
Okay. How would one get points on the driving license if they commit an offense?
If they don't have an Indiana license, but you commit an offense.
Yeah.
I believe the Indiana BMV creates a profile for you and they give you certain, I don't know, they give you a number, you know, a bunch mm-hmm. of a long list of numbers, and that's now kind of your license information.
Okay. That makes sense. I was just curious about the data. Okay. All righty. Any more questions, or else we'll move on to our next panelist. Cool. Thank you again, Leslie. And our next panelist is Tammy from CARE. So Tammy, do you want to take it over?
Thank you so much. I do have a PowerPoint presentation that I'm going to start momentarily, but I too want to thank you for inviting me for Mental Health Awareness Week. And my office and my slides, we often, as Leslie, you know, students aren't coming to her office generally because things are going super great. And that's the same with the Center for Advocacy, Response, and Education. And sometimes graduate students, you all can feel like you're in a more precarious situation, or have a lot of layers to some of the situations that might bring you to the CARE office. So I am going to go ahead and find my presentation here. We're located in Windsor, which is a residence hall, Doomy Hall specifically. Our entrance is off of First Street, and the building is unlocked from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And right now, most of my appointments are virtual, but due to the nature of the work that we do, I am able to meet face-to-face with social distancing and masks. If needed. And I will consult with students via phone, email, whatever the individual is comfortable with. And we are confidential. The Counseling and Psychological Services, as well as the Purdue University Student Health Center, are the only other offices on campus that are confidential. And so what that means is if you choose to utilize our services, then we won't talk about, oh, Leslie's office is also confidential. We will not share that you came and inquired about services or utilized services. And we focus on working with individuals. We work with staff and faculty as well as undergrad, grad students who experience sexual violence, dating violence, stalking, any sort of gender-based harassment or discrimination. And we really empower individuals to understand what their rights and options are and help them access the resources in which they are comfortable. So with CARE, we're never going to tell an individual what they need to do, what they should do. We will make sure that the person feels validated, supported, and knowledge about what their options are given this situation that's not good that has happened. Sometimes these situations don't happen to students directly, but they can happen to their peer or a good friend, someone that you are very close to. In grad school, that can be that can make things difficult if it happens within a department. And so CARE also provides advocacy and support for friends who might be trying to support their friend, roommate, peer, partner through a power-based personal violence situation. These situations can be stressful for all involved, not just the person directly affected by the power-based personal violence. And so we understand that it's a difficult situation, and we are here on a variety of platforms and a variety of scenarios to support all of our Purdue community. In addition to the direct advocacy and support in a confidential manner, we do prevention education. So it's always fun to be able to come to forums like this. We will come to student orgs if invited. We have a variety of different presentations, or we could tailor one specific to your needs. So that's a bit about our mission. Power-based personal violence, we use that term as an umbrella term because all of the behaviors that fall under power-based personal violence have the one thing in common where they're asserting power and control in a manner to with the purpose to intimidate or harm another person. And that's not, that doesn't feel good. And sexual assault and rape falls into that, as does sexual exploitation. If, in case you're not aware, that would include if you shared a video or a photo with someone when you were in a consenting relationship, and then if the relationship went bad and then they shared those videos or photos without your consent, or if you were photographed or taken any images or video of you without your express permission, then there are some things that we could do to help you through those situations. Sexual harassment could be anything from catcalling to making you feel uncomfortable in a classroom or a work environment. Stalking, that's when someone follows you either physically, virtually, online, with the purpose or result of creating fear or intimidation, making a person feel fearful for their safety. That's a situation that CARE can help with. And relationship violence, intimate partner violence, we provide services to all students, regardless of gender, sexual identity. Our services are for all of our community, and we do make sure that we get some specialized training through the state of Indiana, through the Core 40 training, as well as other trainings that our centers, like the LGBTQ Center and other entities provide so that we are more sensitive to the needs of all of our community. We think it's very important, and we know that some of our marginalized communities have some dynamics of power-based personal violence that might require some special knowledge and attention. And so we want to make sure that everyone is aware that we serve all of our community. So if you find yourself or someone that you know in a situation that falls under power-based personal violence, it's important for you to know that mandatory reporters at Purdue are individuals, faculty, staff members that could reasonably take action if you told them. So some examples would be deans, vice presidents, the Office of the Dean of Student Staff. Those would all be examples of mandatory reporters. A lot of times, academic advising at a certain level could be. It really depends upon the department. They're not confidential, federally mandated to report, but CARE is confidential. So again, if you're not sure what you want to do, you're not sure what your options are, or you're trying to connect your friend or partner, other loved one, to supports and services because of a situation, CARE is a great place to start because we are confidential and we can help students understand what their rights and resources are. And as they pertain to reporting, so if someone experiences sexual violence, they might choose to report that to law enforcement. A confidential CARE advocate, we could talk with the student and help them identify which law enforcement agency it's appropriate to report to, should that be something that they're interested in. And usually the law enforcement agencies are Purdue, West Lafayette Police, the Tippecanoe County Sheriff's Office, and the Lafayette Police Department. Those are the ones that we utilize the most if the student wants to report it to law enforcement. If the student doesn't want to report it to law enforcement, but the other involved party is a Purdue student, then the university has administrative reporting options. We have Title IX policies and anti-harassment policies that people can be held accountable if they engage in behaviors that are against our policies. And so we can talk with students and help them understand what all of their rights and reporting options are. Access to medical care. If an individual feels that they need some medical attention, we will help facilitate that, help them identify what their options are, whether or not they would like to have forensic evidence collected or not, STI testing or treatment if there is a need for that, as well as counseling services on or off campus. We also have a 24/7 support line. You call our main number, 765-495-CARE, which is 2273, and you follow the automated prompt and you can speak with a trained professional after hours, after 5 p.m. on weekends and holidays. And if there is something for a confidential advocate to do during that time, then the trained professional will call us on call and we will get in contact with the student. If there is no action item to do at that moment, we will follow up the next business day if that would be helpful. We can accompany students to make reports to the police, or if they do decide to file a formal complaint with the university, we can serve as their support person through all of that, help them understand what to expect in the process and provide support and validation throughout the entire process. Academic assistance is another really big piece of what we can do. We can work with students, understand kind of what their situation is, and then help them think about things that they can do to notify instructors. We can facilitate instructor notification or seeing about moving deadlines or forgiving attendance, pushing exams back if that's appropriate for the situation. My office, we are the only office on campus where we are, we have access to the database for online protective orders, and we've got some specific expertise in helping individuals apply for protective orders in certain instances of harassment, stalking, or sexual violence. And we can work with students to figure out if that's an avenue that they would like to pursue and support them through that. We make a lot of different referrals. We have a lot of different resources available. We will work with parents just on a different level to help them understand maybe what their student may be going through and ways that they can help support their student through one of the most difficult situations. But if the student hasn't signed a release, we would never tell the family member that we are working directly with a student. Lastly, we do provide, these are our most commonly requested workshops, Power-Based Personal Violence 101, Boiler Up and Intervene, that's our bystander intervention program, and then we have something on healthy relationships and how to support a survivor. I will let you know that I'm an office of one right now, so I have put most of those on hold for the spring term, and I do anticipate, like I said, being able to hire a prevention programming specialist and an assistant director this summer, and we should be back up and running full throttle in the fall. We also will be resuming our educational ambassador program in the fall. And so if you or anyone else, we accept undergrad and graduate students to train them to facilitate our programming, our prevention programming. And so that can be a fun way for students to be involved. And we do have a couple of grad students and professional students who are passionate about preventing and eliminating power-based personal violence. So if that's something that you're interested in, please feel free to connect with me. This last slide has our contact information. Our email is care@purdue.edu. There's our phone number and our website, purdue.edu/odo/care. You can email us if you want to inquire about setting up an appointment. You can call or you can walk in, and those are all ways to connect with us. I am going to go ahead and stop sharing my screen. And I would also like to say, I didn't say during the presentation, that individuals are never required to disclose lots of details of their situation in order to access resources and or be made aware of resources and services available to them. Because we truly, I said, take an empowerment-based approach, and we would never want to make someone feel like they had to share more than they were comfortable to get important access to resources and services. And sometimes if a student isn't comfortable sharing, that's fine. And we can work with that. I never want a student to feel like they can't come to us because they don't feel comfortable sharing all of the details. That is okay. We really are here to meet the student where they are and get them connected to all of the important resources, because power-based personal violence is, it can feel like a very lonely place. And we want you to feel like you can be a student, that we can make those accommodations, connect you to those resources, so to minimize the disruption of your academics as much as possible. You are, especially grad students, in a very, your programs are rigorous and they are demanding. And And our services are here for grad students too. So that is my spiel, if you will, about the CARE office. And I am happy to take any questions. If you don't want to ask your question, or you have a thing that you would like to share privately, you can contact me through the care@purdue.edu email, or my direct email, which is Patrick, P-A-T-R-I-C-K, and the letter T, at purdue.edu. And you can feel free to reach out in any of those modes for support, or if you have questions and you would prefer to do that privately.
So thank you, Tammy, for the presentation. So I think we have some time for some Q&A session, and I think I see one question in the chat already.
The question is, does CARE look into issues such as toxic workplace environments? So I will say it depends. So we do have an office on campus called the Office of Institutional Equity that focuses more on that specific type of concern. But anytime you add, if there's gender-based harassment, discrimination, or any of the other behaviors that fall under that power-based personal violence, then CARE certainly has, it would be an appropriate resource. Sometimes those toxic workplace environment situations can have flavors or elements of gender-based harassment or discrimination. And so I would always say err on the side of, if you're not sure, then feel free to reach out to us. And if it's not the CARES office, if it's not something that we can help with, as the director, I believe in soft handoffs, meaning we would never be like, we don't do that, sorry, and just send you, you know, be like, we would make sure that we were sending you to the correct place before we were sending you away.
So I'll give it a minute or so more in case anyone has any questions that they're currently typing. But all right, so it looks like we don't have any more questions, but thank you again so much, Tammy, for your presentation. I think people will find it very helpful, and we'll have the recording online in about a week or so. So next we're gonna have the ACE Campus Food Pantry presentation. So that's it.
Awesome, yeah, let me get my slideshow up. Great. So why do we need a pantry anyway? So my name's Riley. I'm the event director for the campus food pantry. So I run most of our like online engagement events and stuff like that. I'm also the shift lead. So if you come in from 12 to 3, I'll be serving you. And then that's Vanessa Pacheco. She's amazing. She's our advisor. So you'll see her around from time to time. So numbers on food insecurity. Obviously, a lot of these numbers don't take into account COVID. Early studies suggest that levels have risen dramatically during the pandemic. So, you know, just take that in mind. But 48% of college students were food insecure, with 22% showing very low levels of food insecurity from this 2016 study. You know, meal plans don't stop you from being food insecure, and a lot of food insecure Students are also working jobs, which is another level of difficulty. Just trying to manage all the stuff going on in your life and still find a way to consistently cook for yourself and get to the grocery store, get to restaurants and stuff like that. And this is just another report talking about sort of the climate in academia of that you're supposed to be hungry or that college students are supposed to live on nothing but ramen and stuff like that, which is, you know, sort of like a cultural thing. And there's this big stigma around, you know, hunger in college. And this is another quote about just, you know, the difficulty of balancing academia and exams and stuff like that with getting a healthy diet. So what is ACE doing about it? So what is ACE? We're a student organization. We've existed since 2015 when CELD, the Civic Engagement and Leadership Development Office, founded it with a volunteer organization on campus. Our goal is to create a world where we don't need food pantries. And in the short term, address the hunger on campus until we can make that happen. And so we started in 2015 with that partnership that I mentioned earlier, as well as partnering with the Baptist Student Foundation, just in terms of housing. We're housed in their building. So if you come around to the back door, we serve people out of the parking lot there. So what are our values when we're serving people? Availability, access, use, cultural appropriateness, and consistency. So availability is that, you know, there should always be somewhere on campus that you can find food. The pantry is open on Tuesdays and Sundays, and we try to get full coverage for the rest of the week. So we have, I think, 6 pop-ups right now in the BCC, LCC, AARC, Horizons, the CO-REC, and probably one or two other places, and the vet school. So you should hopefully, ideally, always be able to find somewhere. We also keep pop-ups open over winter break. And the main pantry location is open all summer. So access, we're open to everybody at Purdue. There's no requirement to come to the pantry. You don't have to qualify in any way. The only thing you need to bring is your Purdue ID number. You don't even need the card. You just need to remember the number. And everything's no cost. And use, you know, there's no point in giving people food that they can't use. So a big part of working at the pantry is trying to show people who, especially younger college students who, you know, this might be your first time cooking for yourself, just kind of that entry level cooking skills and how to use some of the ingredients that we give away. And cultural appropriateness, the main way we engage with that is by educating our donors. And by interacting with our clients in a way that lets them, you know, stay true to their dietary guidelines, making it clear what's in different food items so that they don't feel compromised by anything that we serve, and consistency, trying to give people a dependable source of food on campus. So our structure, we've got 10 student directors. I'm one of them, 14 weekly volunteers and leads. I'm also one of the leads. We used to engage about 70 students weekly. Now that number is much smaller due to COVID. We have one head student director, NERM, if any of you have encountered him, and about 150 community members and students engaged each semester. That number is probably still lower now during the pandemic, but yeah, what can you do? What is it really like? So essentially the way the pantry works, if you've never used us before, is that you just come. Now we have a menu system. So you come and provide me or one of the other shift leads with your student ID. And then you just pick out what you want. We operate on a point system. So essentially what that means is each food item has a certain amount of points that it like costs. And then you just sort of go up to the limit. The point system isn't a rigid structure. So if you need more food than that, then you can just talk to us and, you know. And then it's 20 points for larger households. So if you live with roommates or if you have a family or kids or a partner, then it's 20 points per person that way. Here's a few of our pop-up pantries. So Horizons, the CO-REC, the BCC, LCC, to get more coverage during the week. How have we adapted to COVID and how are we keeping you safe while you're visiting the pantry? So the menu system, which I mentioned before, we used to operate on a like shopping system. We essentially had shelves set up like a shop, like a grocery store, and you come through and pick out what you want. Obviously that's ideal because then people get the most say over what they get, but we figured this was the best way to sort of balance giving people food they want with keeping everybody safe and away from each other. Appointments, we've moved to appointments now, so you have to call or text this number to get like a time slot. That's something else that we didn't want to do, but we kind of have to balance convenience for our clients with keeping everybody safe. And then the other measures, everybody gets temperature checked before they come in the pantry. Masks are always required, and we sanitize all the food that we get. And what can I get a day? So what are some of the items that are available on a typical day? We've got produce. So that'll be generally during the summer, we'll have lots of like fresh fruits and veggies. In the top right, you can see a bunch of fresh produce that we got through our partnership with the student farm. The student farm on campus is amazing. They do organic, delicious fresh produce, and they give it to us for free. And then we also have meat, milk, you know, just various fresh items, lots of bread. We get a lot of stuff from Panera now. Canned goods, you know, we'll have a huge variety of canned goods, vegetables, canned tuna, soups, stuff like that. Dry goods, so stuff you can keep in your pantry like dry beans, rice, shelf-stable milk, stuff that, you know, can last. Prepared meals, hamburger helper type stuff that you can sort of make a whole meal out of a smaller amount. And snacks and drinks, so stuff like chips, crackers, and, you know, candy and stuff like that. And toiletries. Toiletries are the only item on the menu that doesn't cost any points other than produce. Because we don't want people wondering or trying to cut back on their food so that they can, you know, have enough points for tampons or toothbrushes or stuff like that. Those are essential items. So anybody can get, you know, whatever toiletries they need, pads, tampons, toilet paper, soap. Yeah. And what else do we do? So this is kind of my side of things. This is my narcissistic slide because this is mainly what I do. Cooking demos. We do a lot of cooking demos. Previously, we would offer them in person. So you'd be in a kitchen and you'd cook alongside a chef. We can't do that anymore. So now we have a YouTube channel where you can sort of meet some of the members of ACE, and we'll do different partnerships and stuff like that. We're upcoming. We're partnering with the ARC to do a South Asian curry cooking demo, which we're excited about. We do garden giveaways. I'm our garden coordinator. So I'm always giving away plants and stuff like that. So we'll do that and like tips on how to take care of them and stuff like that. And we also do food justice events. So recently, if any of you heard of it, we did our talk with Ron Finley, who, you know, does a lot of community gardening and food sovereignty efforts out of South Central LA, which is really cool. So we just had him kind of come in and talk about the food system and gardening and food sovereignty. And just sort of offer that resource to people. So this is just a little information about our client base, if anybody is interested. Since July 2019, we had about 2,200 visits to our main pantry location. We don't track visits to the pop-ups, so we don't know how many people go to the pop-ups. Here's a basic rundown of which colleges are the biggest for us: engineering, agriculture, liberal arts. College of Science has dropped off a little bit in recent years. 54% of our clients are female students. 58% are international students. 22% are students of color, not counting the international students because the demographic information is weird. So 22% of our non-international students are students of color. Yeah, and since COVID, we've had 104 unique clients, 83 students, 23 staff and faculty for about, I think, just under 2,500 visits this year. Since COVID has happened, we've seen a huge spike in usage. We've had increased usage every single year that we've been open, and that trend is continuing this year. I think we've already reached our number for all of fall. This past fall, just so far in this semester. So we're already on track for that. Here's a little thing. We're open now. And yeah, this is our contact information. So you can find us on Facebook. You can email us here. You can DM us on Facebook, Instagram. You can watch our YouTube videos. We also have a website that you can go to if you want to find more about the pantry. And yeah, that is the end of my presentation. Does anybody have any questions?
So yeah, I actually have a question. So what if there's something, what's something that Purdue as a university could do to support your mission at ACE?
Like the administration or just the wider campus?
Yeah, like administration, for example.
So administration, something we've been trying to get done for a while is, you know that section in syllabuses where it shouts out CAPS and says, for any students who are struggling, you can go to CAPS. So there's also an optional insert that professors can decide to add in that shouts out the food pantry. Something that we've been trying to get added onto syllabuses for a while is just sort of like a basic needs section on the end of syllabuses to get it required and not optional, because most professors don't really care, don't want to do anything extra, which is understandable. So we've been trying to get an basic needs section required so that we can shout out not just ACE, but also like the period project. I forget who does housing on campus, but other, you know, basic needs organizations on campus, just so people are aware of those resources. So like, for example, we could do that. And, you know, just sponsoring us for events and grants and stuff like that is a lot of what we need. Good question, Roberta. You can donate money to ACE. We have like a donation page that's online. You can email us to get the link to that. You can donate items by also emailing us to set up a time, or you can come in during our open hours. Yeah, and anybody can donate to us. So yeah, anybody who's not affiliated to Purdue can absolutely. Like this summer, we got just a random person in Lafayette, or not a random person, but just somebody in the Lafayette community who wasn't directly affiliated with Purdue, who gave us like, I think 75 live plants that they had just grown in their garden. So tons of like tomatoes and peppers and stuff like that. So yeah, we get a lot of, you know, amazing stuff just from members of the community who care. Peak times, generally we're busiest right when we open. Our peak needs are usually like, other than produce, you know, obviously we always need produce, but donating it can kind of be tricky because it's spoils so much faster than anything else. But I would say, like, in terms of what we need the most for donations is like dry rice, dry beans, canned proteins, so like chicken, beans, stuff like that, heartier items, and stuff that you can cook with, so like flour, oil, spices. Yeah, did that sort of answer your question, Roberta? Awesome. Rob?
Oh, I think I accidentally sent a question privately, but do you have a preference? Does the pantry have a preference regarding monetary or physical item donations?
That's a good question. See, so there's strengths to both. What we gain primarily through the monetary donations is we have a partnership with a food bank, Food Finders, if you're aware of them. So we can buy items in bulk at an extremely discounted price. So we can get large quantities of items from them, but typically the items that we buy from them are all the same. So there's not a lot of variety. So where the like physical donations come into play is in people giving us sort of like just stuff from their pantry and giving us the variety that, you know, people want at a pantry. But the bulk of what we get is monetary donations. So typically I would say monetary donations are the most beneficial, but I don't say that to push people away from physical donations, because they absolutely have a place in our operation too.
To add on to that, so what kind of things are you looking for in physical donations? Like what can't you get from food finders, for example?
Good question. Definitely oil. We never get oil from food finders. I don't know why, because it's such a cooking essential. You know, you can't cook almost anything without oil. But really just like weird stuff, you know, like we can get like the canned stuff and stuff like that, but just things that you enjoy eating, like, you know, a type of chips or something like that. Like, just take something that you enjoy and give it to the food pantry, because the odds are that someone else will enjoy it too. And just because they're food insecure doesn't mean that they shouldn't enjoy their food. So, you know, yeah, but we get a lot of snack items from them typically. So like, you know, heartier stuff is always good. But just, you know, think of the person who's going to be getting that food. And if you enjoy it, you know, they probably will too. Were there any more, or? Cool.
Yeah, so I'll give it a couple more seconds to see if anyone has any questions, but thank you so much for your presentation. All right, so thank you again for your presentation. So next we're gonna hear about Grow from Rob.
Hi, okay, I'm going to share my screen for some slides. I'm gonna do it like this because I don't know how to do that other way, but that's okay. I'm speaking on behalf of Graduate Rights in Our Wellbeing, or GROW. We are an organization that does labor advocacy for Purdue graduate workers. We are all Purdue graduate workers, and we act in solidarity with all workers on campus. Our goals, we want there to be widespread recognition at all levels that graduate students are workers. You'll notice in the presentation, I will always refer to grad students as workers from this point forward. Second, we want safe, fair, and democratic working conditions on campus. We want administrative transparency and accountability, and we want workers to have a meaningful say in all the decisions that are made about us. So yeah, since it's Mental Health Awareness Week, I'm gonna be talking a bit about mental health. We think of mental health as a labor issue. It's a workplace safety issue, really. So everyone deserves to work in a safe and healthy environment. Typically for graduate students, the workplace isn't very conducive to positive mental health. Grad workers experience mental health problems at higher rates than the general population. So there's a study that came out, I think early 2020, that grad students are 6 times more likely than the average adult population to experience severe depression. So that's pretty astounding, and it speaks to some kind of issues with culture that some other panelists have already touched on. For example, these power imbalances that kind of enable power-based violence and harassment and issues like that. Economic insecurity and food insecurity, which result from relatively low wages, unstable funding, unstable pay periods, lack of affordable childcare and affordable housing, the fees that we pay on top of already not being paid very much. It also comes from competition, right? So there's this pressure cooker environment where everyone is, it feels like you're competing with everyone else in your cohort to get a small number of jobs, when in reality, it's maybe not necessarily true, but that kind of feeling is encouraged. And then also, of course, systemic racism, sexism, ableism, xenophobia, homophobia, all of this amplify that. We believe that the root cause of this issue in academia is academic austerity. And basically what I mean by austerity is this drive to cut budgets, to balance the budget, to make the university more efficient financially, They're saving money, but it's coming at the expense of workers. So for one example of how this kind of works at a macro scale, budget cuts mean that one way that money gets saved to balance the budget is automation, replacing staff members with programs that people can run themselves. That means a lot of administrative work gets offloaded to faculty, and faculty don't have time in the day to do all that they need to either contribute to their tenure packets or to teach their classes, do their research, manage their labs, apply for grants. And so that means they pass off more work to graduate students, graduate workers, and adjuncts who are paid less and end up doing more work. So at the same time, another way that money is saved is through hiring freezes. So fewer people are being hired, people are actively being cut, while the university expects the same level of output or more output than before, because growth is good, right? Which means that individuals have a lot more pressure and a lot more work that they each have to do. One way that austerity is kind of expressed is through benefits in the workplace. So everyone deserves access to healthcare, including mental health care, period. Since the United States, unfortunately, doesn't provide this nationally, it really comes down to employers. And for graduate workers and other campus workers, Purdue University is that employer. Thankfully, we do get health insurance through our job, but there's a really big issue that there's very limited availability of local healthcare providers, especially in mental health services. So that means for every outside provider, there's long wait times. I've heard 6 to 12 months quoted recently. I myself waited 6 months to see someone when I expressed that it was urgent. So we also don't have vision benefits included in our health insurance. We get an eye exam covered, but we don't get actually glasses or contacts. So that's a problem. Like, I know that I can't see, but I can't afford to replace these glasses, right? So dental could also be better. We can buy it separately. It doesn't cover as much as it could. Anyway, so benefits, that's somewhere that the university can save money, and it has done so. Another place that Purdue could be spending money but is deciding to save money instead is providing healthcare directly. So this is through CAPS for mental health and through push for more physical health issues. Right, so a little bit more on CAPS. There's been a lot of issues that students have had with CAPS, and it is a great service when you can get access to it. But for a population of like 46,000 students, I think was the number that Leslie mentioned, CAPS isn't necessarily sufficient for all of those people. I can't meet all of their needs. So what's happened at CAPS in recent years is they've moved to a stepped care model, which basically means there are different levels of care that you get, and they do an initial assessment. And after they do that assessment, they decide, okay, you only need a mood tracking app. You need to go to group therapy. You need individual sessions, or you're out of our scope. You should go see someone in the community. That model is great. It really reduces wait times. It's a very efficient model, but it really only works if there's enough money invested in the entire system to meet everybody's needs. So if there are a lot of people on campus who need individual sessions with therapists, if there are not enough therapists, those people are going to end up having to go to group sessions, even when they're when that wouldn't benefit them most. So recently we saw a study come out in a university senate meeting. I think that was last month or earlier this month. No, it would have been last month. It demonstrated that there was decreasing demand for CAPS in the first part of 2021. And I would like to question that. I think that the presentation of data wasn't necessarily very clear. We don't know how most of 2021 is gonna go, so we will see. But when we did a survey on mental health in the beginning of 2020, before coronavirus really happened and made everything different, the results that we found were that people were really confused about how to access CAPS services. they've been turned away or had bad experiences in the past, either with racism in the process or with being recommended to kind of like levels that didn't fit them. Another point of feedback we got was that they've run out of sessions. They'd been to CAPS, it was working great, but they hit their 12 session limit and they had no more, and they still were in need of services. And then the last thing that we found was that there was not a lot of trust in the system. So if people are already discouraged that CAPS is not going to serve them well because of what they've heard, because of all of the experiences that they've had in the past, that means they probably won't seek out that help again. So this is a place where we do need money invested, and divesting from workers kind of directly hurts our access to healthcare services. Another point I want to touch on in this benefits picture that I'm painting is the grit narrative, and I'm sure that you've all heard of this, as it is, it's kind of a meme, like it really is. So the idea that we should be resilient to anything that life tosses our way, even if the things being tossed are horrible, even if the things are completely avoidable and people choose not to avoid those things, saying that we should be resilient to all of those things is offloading these systemic problems to individuals. And then on top of that, saying that grit means you shouldn't be looking for help, which actually happened in a commencement speech that our university president gave. All of these kind of contribute to the idea that we don't need to be using CAPS, right? If the onus is on us to maintain great mental health, there's no need to kind of provide these benefits for people, right? And then you can see, oh, people are not using CAPS because, I should be resilient on my own, or people will laugh at me, or then the numbers go down and there's less need to invest. So it's all kind of part of this divestment from workers' benefits. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that no amount of self-care can make a harmful situation healthy. And sometimes self-care means changing the situation. Another way in which austerity kind of attacks workers, and I promise I'm going to some point here, is with pay. So grad students' minimum pay for this university is about $20,000 a year for full-year students. Some graduate students are not paid for the full year, so they're going to get paid a lot less. But $20,000 a year pre-taxes comes down to about $20.80 per hour if you only work 20 hours per week, which is what is in our employment offer letter, right? A living wage, for comparison, is closer to $25 per hour in 2020. Okay, so like just under a living wage, but still pretty good when you consider minimum wages, $7.25 an hour. Cool. But the other issue is, who among us only works 20 hours a week? That is kind of a laughable number for a lot of people in graduate school. I've heard most people saying 40 hours, some people saying up to 60 hours. Working above that amount of time that we are paid for is very, very common, and in fact, it's expected. So in addition to that, many grad workers are forbidden from holding outside jobs to supplement income. When I was in the forestry department, that was actually in my offer letter, and I had to sign that and I had to agree to it. And it didn't really matter if I didn't have enough money to get by. So, right, okay. And many people don't have outside financial support. And I will say that there are these great programs on campus like ACE, like CARE, like Student Legal Services, that really do help provide these kind of services that you need money for, that you don't have money for. But we should be getting paid an amount that we don't have to worry about this. Because economic stress is really a major stress, and it contributes and adds on to the already really difficult situation that grad school is. So, what GROW does as an organization is we are a labor advocacy. We organize for your rights. We are fighting the austerity policies that hurt grad workers. We are changing that harmful situation that self-care won't fix. So in 2019, which was kind of the year that we formed, we ran the Protect Purdue campaign. Wow, I'm sorry. I have Protect Purdue in my brain. Purdue Pay campaign. Basically what happened for that was the university decided to switch to an automated payroll system. Okay, no problem, right? This is part of their cutting staff automation system. They changed from monthly pay to biweekly pay, which kind of messes with the number of pay periods in a year. They decided, okay, we're going to front load your pay for the first couple of months, and then we'll take all of the difference out in the summer. So what ended up happening was people saw an amount that they were expecting every month because that is what had been what it was. And in the summer, in a much shorter period of time, there was like a 40 to 50% reduction in the pay that they received. And so people weren't expecting this. They didn't have time to prepare for it. They didn't have time to save. And there was a lot of issues with people not being able to afford food. We were referring people to ACE. We were referring people to the food bank in Lafayette. We were hearing stories of people selling their possessions to make ends meet, to pay rent. Right, and so we pushed back against that. We ran a social media campaign. We advocated with the deans of the graduate school, and we eventually won an increased amount in repayment time for grad emergency loans. In fact, some workers even got their pay back when it became clear that some of the calculations that they'd done weren't legal because some grad students switched from between types of contracts. So, right, so that was our campaign 2019. In 2020, we were working pretty heavily on coronavirus protections. So workers deserve to be safe at work. Right, so some of the efforts that we did there, we created an online petition, got many, many signatures. Again, worked with the dean of the graduate school. Our efforts, along with the efforts of other organizations, meant that PPE was provided for departments and for instructors. There were actually codified protocols for addressing noncompliance so that, TAs who would have to tell people to wear masks in their class would have kind of guidelines for how to do that and like accountability once they had done that. And we won reimbursement for quarantine housing. So at the beginning of the pandemic, it was gonna be like $400 a week to quarantine. And due to our efforts, including a protest outside our university president's house, they said that they would use CARES Act funding to pay for those housing times. We also were part of the effort to get an immigration lawyer on campus, which was something I know PGSG was also working for. And I think most recently, like Leslie mentioned, that's kind of come to free sessions with an immigration lawyer monthly on campus. For mental health, we worked alongside in parallel to JAM, and additional therapists were hired, including therapists of color, to hopefully address some of the issues with CAPS being underfunded and also not at the time having enough culturally competent care. So in the works, we have a couple of FOIA requests on several of the Protect Purdue decisions that were made because we feel that they weren't made democratically or with workers in mind. So we are trying to access those public records and still waiting to see where that's going, but we'll keep you posted. And then the last kind of function that we serve is mutual aid, support, and care. So for mutual aid, we're really good at navigating the system. We know about a lot of resources as a group, even if each individual doesn't, somebody generally does. And so if you have a problem, we can generally kind of tell you your options and tell you who on campus or who off campus can help you address those. We're good for emotional support and airing grievances. If you're having a problem with your boss, come talk to us about it and we can help point you in the right direction towards some options that you might have, or just be supportive. A lot of us have been through that. A lot of us are still dealing with that, and having other people in the same situation can be really helpful. We're also a really collaborative group. So we are all about acknowledging grad students don't have to be in competition. We are all ultimately working towards the same thing. And we'll get a lot farther if we collaborate than if we're constantly at each other's throats. And so with that, sharing resources, there is a voucher that we get for being a panelist on this event. And since I already have my food in order, we have a decision channel and I posted, I have $15. Would anyone like it? Are you hungry? Please have my food. So sharing resources, when we have extra, we can provide. So a way that you can get involved with us, we have advocacy hours. Those are, this semester, they're 4 to 5 p.m. on Tuesdays. They're basically open office hours where we hear your complaints, answer questions, hang out, chat, direct you to the correct campus community resources that we know about that you might not know about. And you can also follow us on social media. Our Twitter handle is GradRights. Most of our handles are at GradRights. So check us out or send us an email. We'd love to be in touch. So that's all I got. Any questions?
So I believe there was a question in the chat earlier.
Lauren posted something and I'm gonna scroll up. Do you think the workplace for grad workers during COVID has been better or worse? Well, I think it's not even really a question that it's been worse. Basically, we've heard reports of people feeling pressured to work in person, although they would rather not, although they don't feel safe. We have issues where people are doing many times the amount of work that they would generally be doing as a TA in person to provide like high flex options, which are absolutely wonderful for keeping people safe, keeping people home, but do take up a lot more time and effort and labor than conventional teaching, which isn't really accounted for by PIs who are still expecting you to put out the same amount of research, essentially. It's been difficult for people. I think that's only question in there I see.
So I have a question. Is there anything that you'd like to see happen from Purdue administration as we move back into in-person teaching and work in like the near future?
That's a really good question. So there are a couple of issues that we are advocating for right now. One of them is affordable childcare on campus. So the pandemic has made really, really clear to everyone who's been at home with kids, or everyone who's been at home even with pets, or everyone who's just been at home, period, that childcare and having undivided focus, the luxury of undivided focus is so important to being able to do academic work. And a lot of people really rely on affordable childcare to be able to do that. So making sure that Purdue has a plan in place to have a childcare center set up that's better or at least the same as the Jishki Center is a big thing that we are trying to get.
Awesome, thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, so, there's another question in the chat.
What have I enjoyed working with Girl? So I really appreciate the solidarity. It's really special to me to be in a space where I feel that people are kind of on my side, where people are understanding of how difficult it can be to be in this kind of precarious position where nobody really acknowledges whether you're a student or a worker. It's really a good supportive environment. I've loved that.
Awesome. So I'm not seeing any more questions. So thank you again for your presentation and the Q&A session. And thanks to all of our panelists today. I think this is like a very valuable resource. And since it'll be available online, many more people will be able to access it. Thanks again for your time. Wouldn't be possible without all of your efforts.
Yeah, thank you so much.